And welcome to another edition of Book Talk. I'm Stephen Ussery, and I'm happy to welcome Hampton Sides back to the program today. Hampton is a best-selling author of nonfiction titles like The Ghost Soldiers, Blood and Thunder, and In the Kingdom of Ice. Today we'll be talking about his latest book, On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle, which is published by Doubleday. Hampton, give us a little background on the Korean War. When did the country become partitioned, and when did Kim Il-sung and the communists first start their attempt to seize the entirety of the peninsula?
You know, Korea, historically, is one people, one culture, one country, one land. And it's such a tragedy that it was divided in the first place. It should never have happened. It happened right after World War II, when the Allied powers were sort of carving up the spoils of the Japanese Empire. Korea had been a colony occupied by the Japanese through most of the 1900s. And at the suggestion of a young diplomat who used little more than a National Geographic map as his guide, he said, well, you know, a good place to divide it is the 38th parallel, more or less halfway up the peninsula. The Soviet Union would get the northern half and figure out what to do with it. The United States would get the southern half and figure out what to do with it, with the assumption that the two custodian nations would ultimately unite the two Koreas and back into one Korea, independent Korea, let them have their own election, let them figure out their own political fate. That never happened. Right after World War II, we sort of entered the Cold War and these competing ideologies. The Soviets begin to turn North Korea into a puppet state. They equipped them with a pretty modern army. Kim Il-sung sort of studies at the knee of the master of all this sort of totalitarian regimes. That's Stalin. It becomes a pretty formidable force for such a small little country. Meanwhile, the United States made some kind of lame pledges to defend South Korea, but didn't really adequately defend or give weapons to the South Koreans. There was kind of a low-grade civil war, almost like a civil war, going on between North and South. A lot of border incursions and, you know, crimes of recrimination, much of this having to do with who had collaborated with the Japanese or who hadn't. But then all of a sudden, in June of 1950, Kim Il-sung and his Soviet-backed army steamrolled across the 38th parallel, what he viewed as an artificial border in the first place, with the intention of uniting all of Korea under his communist regime. He took Seoul very quickly. Within 3 days, the capital of Seoul had fallen.
And it's really close to the 38th parallel.
Which is very close, but it was a big city, and you'd think it would have taken weeks and weeks to capture Seoul. Blitzkrieg kind of marched toward the south, pushed the South Korean forces all the way down to the peninsula's southern tip to a place called Pusan, where certain American forces were kind of thrown into the breach to help. And they were holding on for dear life, waiting for reinforcements to arrive, when General MacArthur hatched his famous scheme of doing an in-run around Pusan, going into the port of Incheon and landing amphibiously to reclaim Seoul and drive the North Koreans back beyond the 38th parallel again. So that's sort of the opening setting of my book, is the Battle of Incheon and Seoul.
So why had America chosen to only give like light arms to South Korea instead of giving them artillery and tanks and such?
One of the reasons was that the South Korean leader who emerged, Syngman Rhee was his name, although he was American educated and spoke English and, you know, he was Christian, at least nominally, he proved to be a ruthless dictator. He put down dissent with just endless brutality. Many tens of thousands of civilians who didn't agree with him were executed. And we tended to look the other way because he was not communist. This was the beginning of the Cold War, but he was quite ruthless. And I think Truman and his administration took a dim view of a lot of his policies and felt a little queasy about arming him so thoroughly. And also, honestly, I don't think they perceived Kim to be such a threat. They didn't really think that Stalin would allow Kim's forces to come across in the first place. You know, this was kind of a gentleman's agreement after World War II. So I guess they didn't perceive Kim as such a threat.
What other socio-political things were going on at the time that emboldened the Soviets to think they could have this proxy war go on?
It seemed like in Eastern Europe at this time, every week or two, there was another state, in, later called the Eastern Bloc countries, that had fallen to communism and fallen into the orbit of Stalin's regime. There had been the Berlin airlift, which proved in the end to be a success for the Americans. But, you know, there were proxy wars being fought all over the place in Greece and Turkey. And then also, more importantly, Mao had recently won his prolonged civil war against the forces of Chiang Kai-shek, another victory for communism. So it really began to feel like in the great war that was emerging after World War II between communism and capitalism, it seemed to many that communism was winning and that there was perhaps some truth to this, what we later found out to be a fiction, that there was a world communism. Like, we later learned that these countries all had their own identities and their own agendas and as much dissent as agreement on a lot of policies. But at that time, there was a real fear of world communism and of dominoes falling in all directions. On top of all this, back home, you have this obnoxious young senator from Wisconsin who arrives on the scene that year, Joseph McCarthy, seems to see communists under every rock and is really distorting and inflaming the political environment back home. So it's a very, you know, interesting and scary and perilous time in politics in the United States.
It's amazing how those communists at the time decided to skip the age of industrialization. They just went straight from agrarian to their idealized communism, which, of course, didn't work.
It didn't work at all, obviously. But Mao, you know, we didn't know much about Mao at this point. He was incredibly charismatic. He was also a pretty shrewd tactician and strategist in terms of, you know, his military prowess. And he was new on the scene. We didn't recognize his regime. The UN didn't recognize him. He had a lot to prove. He wanted to sort of flex his muscles on the world stage and show that this ancient culture, but this very, very newly hatched, newly minted country could do big things on the world stage. So that was kind of where he was coming from in the buildup to the Korean War.
And it seems they had quite a laundry list of grievances against the United States.
Going back for over 100 years, you know, going back to the Boxer Rebellion and the Opium Wars and the missionaries that we had sent over there, who many of whom committed various crimes and misdemeanors, at least in their view, and trade wars of one sort or another. And then, of course, the Chinese who had been sent over here to build the railroads and do a lot of other sort of menial labor had been grossly mistreated. There was the Chinese Exclusion Act, you know, the Yellow Peril, you know, all of this kind of stuff. Mao was certainly well aware of that history and used it to kind of fuel his arguments for why they should intervene in the Korean War.
And of course, ignoring their treatment of Korea prior to the Japanese invasion of the area.
Yes, well, you know, unfortunately, Korea has sort of been caught in the middle of lots of different wars and conflicts and been used as the kind of the launch pad for various invasions, whether it's the Chinese, the Manchurians, the Russians, certainly the Japanese that had just brutalized that country during World War II and during its colonial occupation in the 20s and 30s leading up to World War II. So this poor country, which, you know, there's a proverb that says that they are shrimp among whales, that they're this tiny country that history has pushed around. Certainly true. But sort of simmering at the, you know, at the bottom of all that turmoil is this great hope and this great dream that they will one day be an independent nation again and that they will be able to become a power again and sort of realize their national identity, never dreaming that a line would be drawn right across the waist of their country and suddenly it would become two countries.
And at the time, the South had about twice the population of the North because the North is a pretty brutal area as far as topography goes.
Mm-hmm. Well, the South had the capital and had the largest population by far, but it tended to be, at the time of the partitioning, quite agricultural. The North had most of the resources, including metals, semi-precious metals, and turns out uranium, hydroelectric power plants that had been built by the Japanese. So the Soviet Union was quite pleased with their spoils. They got less population, but much more infrastructure and much more industry and much more resources. We just got saddled with a very large and very distressed post-war population of folks in and around Seoul primarily, and the rest of the country being rice-growing, you know, agrarian, extremely poor. You know, I think now we've come to think of Korea as this engine, this incredible economy that they have. They are the 11th largest economy in the world. Seoul is one of the largest cities in the world now, and it's a functioning democracy, and everything work. You know, everything works. But back then, it was just incredibly poor, and the conditions were deplorable and very rural.
So when the North had pushed down and contained the Southern Korean forces and the American forces around Pusan, what was General MacArthur, who was in charge of the area, what was his plan to recapture the South and reassert control?
Well, I think, you know, he was trying to think counterintuitively. He was saying, well, let's not put more and more and more material into this little besieged perimeter, the Pusan perimeter down at the tip. Why don't we go behind enemy lines, and why don't we stage an ambitious amphibious landing? And let's do it in a place that no one would expect us to go to, because Incheon is a place that has these notoriously extreme tidal fluctuations. Bad place to try to do an amphibious landing, because if you time it wrong, you end up on these slimy tidal flats that would leave you exposed. You'd be a sitting duck out there. Your vehicles couldn't get across. And so that's certainly one reason why MacArthur said its very unsuitability as a landing place is why it's a great place to land, because it'll surprise them, the element of surprise. MacArthur was always thinking, you know, in sort of dashing terms. You know, he loved the unexpected. He loved the grandiose. And he was quite ambitious, obviously, and quite arrogant, someone who was sort of at the height of his power. He had been essentially the emperor, the de facto emperor of Japan since the end of World War II, during the occupation there. He was the head of all the UN forces. He was the head of the U.S. forces in the Far East. And he was, you know, someone who believed his own press, always had sort of had that flaw. He was quite narcissistic, in love with the vertical pronoun, someone who felt he was always right.
Insulted three presidents in his time.
Yeah, yeah. And it was said MacArthur didn't have a staff. He had a court, because he had surrounded himself in Tokyo with all these sort of yes men and sycophants. But, you know, it was a brilliant idea. It was an incredibly risky idea, Incheon. It could very well have failed, but it didn't happen to fail. It worked. The Marines, who played really the central role in my book, the 1st Marine Division, were really why it succeeded. They pulled off this initial invasion like textbook. It was beautifully choreographed, and they got ashore, and they sort of established their beachhead, snuffed out the North Korean resistance. And very quickly, this huge, you know, armada of ships, getting to the size of some of the enormous invasions of World War II, amphibious invasions, not as big as Normandy, but, you know, massive nonetheless. These ships all pull in with their material. 75,000 troops arrive. They very quickly storm their way up to Seoul and recapture it from the North Koreans.
At great cost, though.
At great cost. At great cost to the city, especially. It was just pummeled by artillery. And part of that had to do with MacArthur again. He had this idea that the city had to be taken really quickly, because he was trying to capture the city exactly 3 months to the day after Kim Il-sung had begun the invasion, the first capturing of the city. Because he said, and MacArthur had this sort of mythical notion that he understood the Asian mind, as he put it, that he said, you know, Asians are acutely attuned to numerology. And therefore, if we can do it, you know, June 25th is when the war started. If we can make it by September 25th, be 3 months to the day after the war started. And it would be a crushing blow to Kim Il-sung. I don't know if that was true, if there's any truth in that at all. But they declared the city liberated well ahead of the deed. It took a number of weeks before the city was pacified. But the North Koreans did put up a fight for a while, but then they pulled out and they retreated towards the 38th parallel and scattered into North Korea.
Now, the man in charge of making this landing up north possible, Marine General Oliver Smith. And if anyone in the command structure comes across as heroic, it's this man.
And rightly so. Oliver Smith is O.P. Smith, as he's sometimes called, was the commander of the 1st Marine Division. And he's widely regarded as in the pantheon of Marine generals. Interesting guy, by the way. He is not your typical gung-ho Marine that you might have a sort of stereotype about. He was fluent in French, and he'd studied all over the world, and he, you know, read the classics. He smoked a pipe. He cultivated roses. His nickname was the Professor. And he did have a kind of professorial way about him. He was mild-mannered and quiet and quite cerebral. But he very quickly, upon meeting MacArthur and MacArthur's lieutenants, he became quite skeptical of sort of the mentality emanating out of Tokyo, all these yes men that MacArthur had. Particularly one guy, General Ned Almond, who was MacArthur's right-hand man. He was a general in charge of the 10th Corps, which the Marines were attached to. 10th Corps was just this huge, unwieldy amalgam of forces, mostly Army troops, who would be going into North Korea. And Smith began to have personality conflicts with Ned Almond. He thought that Ned Almond was quite cavalier and brash and the kind of person who didn't seem very concerned with on-the-ground realities, and that he had a lot of, more importantly, a lot of tactical differences with Ned Almond. They just didn't agree on how you go about fighting a war. You know, none of this may matter until they get farther and farther north and the stakes become higher and higher, and they seem to be pushing towards the border with Manchuria. When these personality differences, this clash between these two guys, Almond and Smith, becomes much more accentuated.
Almond didn't have a great reputation, and it was kind of up to MacArthur to kind of salvage his career in World War II.
Yeah, well, Almond had kind of turned in a lackluster performance in Europe. He had been given a large unit of African-American soldiers. This was before the time of the integration of the armed forces. He had been given these African-American soldiers to command because he was a Southerner, a white Southerner. Those seemed to be quite dubious credentials, but he was from Virginia, and supposedly white Southerners understood Negroes, and that's why he was given this group. Well, they didn't actually perform very well in a particular battle in Italy. He had to do a lot of sort of damage control, and he said it was all because they were black. I mean, pure and simple as that. He just said that Negroes, as he put it, they don't make good soldiers. They're cowards, and they're lazy, and they are apathetic. And he actually went on a campaign after World War II to make sure that the U.S. Army would never integrate the troops. So this was the guy that MacArthur somehow took a shining to and rehabilitated his career, brought him over to Tokyo, made him his chief of staff. Perhaps he liked him in large part because Almond was willing to play the game. He essentially did whatever MacArthur told him to do. And he was a dutiful yes man. And someone that MacArthur could send into battle and know that he would do exactly what MacArthur had asked him to do. But, you know, this whole battlefield chemistry and all these different egos starts to play out as they get closer and closer to the Yalu River. And you see Ned Almond's personality in its full light.
Even Alexander Haig, who had served under Almond, didn't have a completely rosy picture of his superior officer.
No. Alexander Haig said he was a torture, you know, to work under, that he was arrogant and brash and, you know, just struck fear. He was the kind of guy who would just waltz in and make a pronouncement with no intelligence, with no discussion, and then march out. They called him Ned the Dread. That was his nickname. So that was the kind of person that General Smith, who really is the protagonist of my book, you know, just a remarkably prescient general. He kind of saw this battle coming when everyone else seemed to not see it. This is just kind of an interesting clash of personalities, these two guys.
So President Truman had specifically and pointedly asked MacArthur, do you think the Chinese will become involved? Because if they're going up toward the border of Manchuria, that could be seen as a threat to the nation of China.
Absolutely. You know, Truman was very concerned with the idea that the Korean War, this localized conflict, could very well become a world war. Understandably scared that the Russians were going to get involved and or the Chinese, and that it would very quickly escalate into a world war. You know, we were still recovering from World War II. We were in our economic recovery, the GI Bill, the economy was starting to boom, and there didn't seem to be a political will back in the United States to get into a situation that could escalate, quickly escalate, a world conflict over capitalism versus communism. So yes, he was very worried about the possible entrance of the Chinese. He flew all the way to Wake Island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean and met with MacArthur. This was the only time they ever met, these two men. He pointedly asked him, are the Chinese going to intervene? MacArthur said all the intelligence indicates they won't. I believe they won't, he said. And even if they did, it would be the greatest slaughter because they had no air force. They were peasant army, a guerrilla army. They didn't have tanks. They didn't have vehicles. They didn't have very good artillery. Don't worry about it. We got this. The war will be over by Thanksgiving, Christmas at the latest. With that, you know, Truman said, keep going. You know, Truman very much liked the idea that the two Koreas could become united as one under a pro-capitalist democratic regime. Everybody back in Washington loved that idea, including the Joint Chiefs of Staff. But no one had the political will, I think, to go forward with that if the Chinese were going to intervene in large numbers. Because everyone knew the Chinese just had a numerical superiority, maybe not in arms, but in numbers, just pure numbers. And of course, that was just a worry that sort of permeated all the thinking back in Washington.
Truman puts his faith into MacArthur. For some reason, did he have a grudge against the Marine Corps?
He didn't particularly like the Marines. That's true. Truman was an Army guy all the way. He'd been an artilleryman in World War I. And he thought the Marines, you know, were a little too fancy and a little too kind of believe their own press. He said they had the greatest propaganda machine this side of Stalin himself. He said some disparaging things about the Marines and said that he intended to really just make them the Navy's police force and make sure that maybe they guarded embassies. And of course, there's the Marine Band. That's okay. But there was a lot of talk in Washington at that time of decimating the Marines, just sort of making them a symbolic force. Part of that had to do with the fact that with the ascendancy of the Air Force and advent of the atomic bomb, a lot of the strategists were saying, well, we're not going to have amphibious invasions anymore. Like, that's sort of a war skill of the past. It's an air war now. The Marines had trained to storm beaches in amphibious assaults. That's really what the Marines are supposed to do. So Truman had bought into some of that thinking that the Marines are going to kind of be phased out. But it does speak to the larger question that I was interested in is sort of like, what is a Marine? Like, why do we have them? They're this kind of weird, they're not fin or fowl or fur, you know, they're their own thing. They're not Army. They're not Air Force. They're attached to the Navy, but they're not really Navy. They're not special operations forces. They're like their own insular force. They have their own aviators. They have their artillerymen, their great infantry, their great riflemen. Not absolutely clear what they're supposed to do in this modern era. And so as this battle begins to take shape, General Smith is realizing that this is a kind of an existential crisis for the Marines, and that this battle, which becomes the Chosin Reservoir Battle, is not only a fight against the Chinese, it's a fight for the very survival and the identity of the U.S. Marine Corps.
I once heard that the Norwegians have a saying about Swedes, and it says, the terrible thing about the Swedes is they think they're always right. Even worse about them, they usually are.
Kind of like the Marines, yeah. Yes. I mean, you know, I think a lot of people who are reading this book who are not Marines will say that I may have drunk a little too much of the Marine Kool-Aid, but I have drunk some of it. I know that the Marines will probably say I didn't drink enough of their Kool-Aid. You know, they love their anthem and their slogans and all, you know, their battle cry and their chesty puller and, you know, their, you know, all their little symbols and icons, their anchor and their globe. And, you know, they think they're the best. And in many battles and many places in the world, they perhaps were the best. They could do more with less, and they seem to have a certain ethos. It's hard to define it sometimes, exactly what that ethos is, but they do well in combat. They look out for each other in a uniquely powerful way. So there is something to the Marines, without question.
Either ironically or appropriately enough, they were there then in the theater where their phrase gung-ho comes from.
Yes, yes. The expression gung-ho actually came from China, some sort of industrial expression that meant work together, work together, work together, gung-ho. That's what the characters mean, the Chinese characters. Here they are fighting against the Chinese, where this expression had originated.
Now, while Truman had his doubts about the self-proclaimed greatness of the Marine Corps, Chairman Mao feared the 1st Division of the Marines enough that he wanted them destroyed utterly to make a point.
He knew that they were among the forces who were marching towards the Yalu. He knew that the Marine Corps, the 1st Marine Division, was the most elite force out there. And if you could destroy them, you would really make a point, a profound point. The Marines had been in China before and prior to World War II. The China Marines that had made a very distinct impression on the Chinese. And there were all kinds of rumors out there about what a Marine was. I'm talking about in China. And it was said that a Marine, to become a Marine, you had to kill a member of your own family, just part of the hazing ritual. It had to be somebody close, like your mother. They were supposedly, you know, boil babies and drink their blood and all kinds of crazy rumors. that they were essentially criminals who had been given guns. And
it's kind of like the hoopla about the Iraqi Republican Guard.
Yeah, the Republican Guard. And, you know, the Marines didn't do a whole lot to discourage those rumors. They kind of liked the idea that they were this sort of diabolical and formidable force. But Mao was clear. He threw a lot of his energies behind attacking the 1st Marine Division, which happened to be pushing towards this reservoir up in the mountains of North Korea, a place called the Chosin Reservoir. He wanted to take out the 1st Marine Division as quickly as possible.
In calling it the Chosin Reservoir, that plays into a difficulty that was there at the time because that's the Japanese name for that area. And much of the materials, maps and recon and such they had were because of the Japanese occupation there.
Right. The topo maps and all the manuals, everything they had on this country up there had Japanese names. When the Japanese took over Korea, they slowly but surely changed all the place names. They were trying to Japanize, is that the word, this country, turn it into a Japanese colony in every respect, including the place names. You know, they wouldn't allow people in Korea to speak Korean. They changed their own family names. So, yeah, you have this place. It's actually the Changjing River, also the Changjing Reservoir. That was what the Koreans called it. The Japanese changed it to Chosin. You know, that's the name that ended up sticking because it was on the maps and it was easier for Americans to say, and it has this ring to it. The men who fought in this battle call themselves the Chosin Few. It's much easier to say than the Changjing Few. It's just not going to stick, you know. It's hard enough to remember these names anyway because they're unfamiliar to the average American. So that's the name that stuck.
The winter of 49-50 had been really brutal around the world, and it looked like the winter of 50-51 was going to be extremely bad as well, especially in that area.
Mm-hmm. As the Marines are pushing up into the mountains, winter descends very dramatically. It was always set up in North Korea that there's only two seasons of the year. There's summer and then winter descends like a samurai's blade. And that's certainly what happened this winter. One day they were marching and the temperature dropped 50 degrees and then ultimately dropped to 25 degrees below zero. The Marines are starting to realize they're going to have to fight in these unbelievable conditions. A lot of these men became sort of psychologically impaired. They were the first couple of days they were just in shock. They couldn't, many of them, move. They were sent to the infirmary in droves. You know, in the old days when armies faced conditions like this, it was pretty typical for them to say, all right, we'll put down our arms and we'll meet each other in the spring, you know, when it warms up again. But that was not the case here. They kept forging ahead. MacArthur really wanted to do this before Christmas. So ignoring those on-the-ground conditions, they kept marching north. They found that their weapons would not fire in this cold. The artillery wouldn't always detonate. The grenades would not always detonate. The IV fluids that the medics used would turn to slush. They began to realize that there's at least two foes they're going to be fighting. They're going to be fighting the Chinese, and they're going to be fighting Old Man Winter in a pretty profound way, much more profound than, say, the Battle of the Bulge, which is a pretty famous battle in cold conditions. You know, as the battle plays out, the winter cold becomes really a constant, unrelenting factor in the progress of the battle.
Now, if Ned Ullman could be accused of being cavalier with the fate of his men and not overly concerned about how many casualties he may incur, Chairman Mao straight up viewed his men as cannon fodder.
Yeah. I mean, it's really deplorable. He sent his men north without gloves, without socks. You know, they had these little flimsy crepe-soled tennis shoes. They had these cotton-quilted uniforms that were just not enough. You know, and he was well aware of the winter conditions in that part of the world. He also sent his troops into battle without weapons. The front row that would initially attack would have weapons, but then they would be mowed down. And the second wave was supposed to come along and scoop up those weapons from their fallen comrades. So it's just deplorable. You know, it's like he was throwing souls away. He had some weird ideas. I mean, he would write that weapons are important, but they aren't the decisive thing. It's people are the decisive thing. And we have plenty of people. He said we have something called fighting spirit, which he believed was unique to the Chinese army and to the revolution that he'd just won in the Civil War. And he was willing to keep throwing just wave after wave after wave after wave of men into the battle. And the Marines, in many ways, felt sorry for them. You know, you talk to Marines today, they tend to tell you that they have no hatred of the Chinese, no resentment towards the Chinese, that they actually felt sorry for them because of the conditions that they were enduring with so little equipment and the extent to which Mao just threw them, into the battle like that.
While their presence, they had kept it secret and moved under cover of night and covered up their tracks while getting there. When they would then launch an attack, they would make as much noise as possible in the process, mm-hmm. I guess to think they were frightening the mm-hmm. enemy.
To allude to the first thing you just said, yeah, they were masters of camouflage. They could move over great distances and not be detected. And this is one of the reasons that MacArthur's men at first had amounted to one of the great intelligence failures in our military history. How can 300,000 Chinese soldiers cross over the Yalu without you knowing it? Well, they were really good at it. They moved only at night. They never moved on roads. They would cover up their tracks with brooms. They would sleep in the forests and down in caves and mine shafts. They were masters of this. This went back to the Civil War. They were a guerrilla force. They knew how to sort of preserve the element of surprise and stealth, relied on things like ambushes, and they knew how to pull away when they needed to pull away quickly. Because they didn't have any vehicles, they weren't tied to the roads at all. They were free to kind of range over the mountains and hide in the valleys. That's one of the reasons they were able to preserve that element of surprise for so long. But yes, once the battle starts, at first to the Marines was just a terrifying thing to listen to this din of cymbals and bugles and horns and drums in the dead of night signaling the Chinese attack. It was perhaps meant to strike fear in the hearts of the Marines, but it was also their primitive, because they had no radios, their primitive but actually reasonably effective method of communication, to signal a charge or to signal to pull back and regroup and so forth. So the first time or the second or the third time it happened, it scared the bejesus out of the Marines. But then they started realizing, well, there goes the element of surprise. At least, they knew they were coming and could prepare for it. But a very strange, strange thing to the ears of the Marines at first.
The lack of the supplies that the Chinese forces had at least kind of played into the fiction of Mao saying, this is the People's Volunteer Army.
Right, right. Yeah, well, and they were supposed to essentially forage for food. They're supposed to steal food or beg or borrow and commandeer it wherever they could find it. And, God help any animal that happened to be in the way of this ravening army that was forging through the mountains of North Korea. Dogs and cats and rats and any vegetables they could find were quickly taken. They were given some food. They were provisioned with rice balls and crackers and some sorghum, barely enough to function. And they weren't supposed to build fires because that would get them detected from the air. The Chinese were rightly fearful of American air superiority. It wasn't even superiority. It was, totality. Like we had an air force and they didn't. But they, they were constantly aware of anything that could be seen from the air. They weren't supposed to build any sort of fires which could be spotted. And that's essentially what they did. Another reason why they were so difficult to spot from these reconnaissance missions.
But the Soviets had become involved in aeronautical way, and we had our first jet-to-jet dogfight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right before the battle starts, we have that. And, these Soviet MiGs were supposed to be superior to American jets. They probably were at first. But the Russians were employing them, but they said they were North Korean pilots. They may have been North Korean pilots, but there was a lot of suspicion that they were also Russian pilots, even in these early days. So just another escalation in this war, this idea that we're fighting not only on the ground, but, jets are fighting each other for the first time. And, of course, there's talk of using nuclear weapons. MacArthur, a little bit later on in the conflict, is actively seeking the use of atomic bombs. All of this just contributes to the total environment of despair that we are slipping into another world war.
In modern kind of geek culture, there's a concept called retconning. It's retroactive continuity, in which something happens in a series and it changes the perception or falls afoul of the canon. So you have to go back and kind of change the view of everything that happened in the past.
Uh-huh.
And MacArthur has to do his own retconning
when
he's asked, why didn't you see the Chinese invasion coming?
Yeah. Yeah, MacArthur had to kind of rewrite his posterity papers. He had to kind of cover his own backside. And he was really good at this. And his various lieutenants were really good at this. They came up with this term, which was reconnaissance in force. Basically, what he's saying is, yeah, we always knew the Chinese were probably out there in huge numbers, but we needed to send a reconnaissance in force to determine that. Meaning, we send our entire army north in the hope that we would learn whether the Chinese were there or not.
You have to poke the beehive to see if there's anything in there.
Something like that. But I start to realize it's kind of a euphemism for any sort of mistake. You know, like you can just say, you know, oh, I knew that was all along. It was a recon in force. You know, MacArthur was really good at kind of coming up with these big terms to describe basic maneuvers and things that sounded much more charismatic and interesting and complicated than they actually were. But yeah, he had his men out there saying that we knew this all along. It was going to happen. And it produced the results we intended from the beginning. We found out that the Chinese were there.
I don't want to give away too much of the action and the tactics that are going on in this battle. But so many of the men served heroically, and we can't even get to a fraction of those that you mentioned in the book. But let's look at a couple of them. And we have first an enlisted man, Private Hector Cafferata Jr.
Mm-hmm. The Chosin Reservoir, the reason I wrote about it is that it really is one of the classic battles in American history and one of the classic battles in the Marine Corps that is still celebrated and studied to this day. It has so many set pieces. It has so many individual acts of heroism and valor because of the extremity of the conditions they were fighting in, you know, the extreme mountains and extreme cold with extremely overwhelmingly huge numbers of enemy surrounding them. It was a complete encirclement. And in the thick of that action, in the worst part of it, was Hector Cafferata on a place called Fox Hill. Cafferata was a 20-year-old kid who found himself in this situation. He was in the very worst part of the worst node of the battle, which was this place, Fox Hill. And that first night, he found himself fighting against the Chinese, hundreds and hundreds of them. He got up out of his sleeping bag and just started shooting. And, you know, here's a guy who never killed anyone in his life, never been in combat before. And by dawn, he killed over 100 Chinese. And he ultimately, a little later that morning, was grievously wounded himself. I got to know Hector shortly before he died. I went to Florida and found him and knocked on his door and prevailed upon him to let me in. And he told me his story, and he's just an extraordinary guy. He was awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor for his exploits that night. And the rest of his days said, you know, I don't deserve this honor. I know plenty of people did a lot more than I did. They didn't get medals. All they got was dead. I'm no hero. And that's certainly the way most of these guys that win these awards and various medals and stars and stuff, that's kind of the way they tend to feel. It's like the real heroes were the ones who died. But Hector was this great guy. He's an Italian-American from New Jersey who was a giant of a guy. He's 6'7" and, you know, a big football player and a kind of a screw-up who somehow found himself in the middle of, you know, the worst of the action and found out the hard way that he was a killer. He was a warrior. He was really good at what he did. He knew that he was a good shot. He had been a marksman all his life, a hunter, but he'd never been in combat before. And you never know what you're going to do or how you're going to react in a situation like that. But the war was over for him at the end of that first day. He got hit in the chest and in the arm, lost a lot of blood, nearly died, eventually was evacuated to Japan.
On the officer side, we'll go for an officer who was in combat, and that was Lieutenant Chu En-Li.
Mm-hmm. Chu En-Li is believed to be the first Chinese-American officer in the Marine Corps. Growing up in Sacramento, had always wanted to be in the Marines for some reason, had narrowly missed combat in World War II. They sent him out to be an interpreter. He found that mortifying. He wanted to be in combat.
He was a Marine.
And he didn't want to be some translator for somebody. In Korea, here he is with the Marine Corps, 1st Marine Division, marching into those mountains when he's surrounded by men of his heritage. You know, his parents were from China. He spoke Chinese. A lot of the officers above him wondered, well, is he going to be trustworthy? You know, that's the same idea that we had in World War II, where like, can we send Japanese into battle and expect them to defend the United States? Well, he quickly proved that he was trustworthy, and then some. He got into a battle and pretended to be an entire army, basically. He would make a little noise over here and then make a little noise over there, throw a grenade, shoot his pistol. The Chinese thought there was a whole group of people coming towards them. It was actually just one guy. Chu Inli, he managed to buy a little time for himself by shouting out in Chinese various things, then assaulted this group and killed all these Chinese, and then himself was injured quite badly, sent to the coast to convalesce in a military hospital. And he said, well, this is not what I came here for. And he escaped from the hospital, stole a Jeep, drove back up into those mountains, found his unit, and resumed his involvement in the war, and ended up leading a large group of men across the mountains to relieve the men of Fox Company. Hector Cafferata's group, you know, was awarded a bunch of medals for his exploits, including two Purple Hearts. An amazing guy. Yeah, you get all these kinds of stories in this battle, these sort of set pieces. They may be spread out over 20, 30 miles from each other, but all these kinds of stories are happening across the battlefield.
While most of the points of view we see are American, we do find the story of a North Korean civilian who is in Seoul when it's under attack from both forces, and that's Lee Bi-suk.
Yeah, Lee Bi-suk. You know, I was really conscious of the fact that, you know, a lot of American battle narratives tend to think, well, you know, this is mainly, you know, an American story. This is our unit, or, you know, this is about American heroism, forgetting the fact that there are almost invariably civilians who get caught in the fray and have their own incredibly beautiful, tragic, sad, heroic story to tell. Well, I was at a reunion of the Chosen Few group in Springfield, Missouri, and I met this Korean-American doctor who lives in Cincinnati, Ohio, and retired, who just told me this story, this amazing story about how he lived in Hamhung, North Korea, which was really where the Battle of Chosin Reservoir starts. It's the city that sort of supports that mountain country. He was from this city, and he had lived under the Japanese occupation and had all these amazing stories to tell about that. And then he was there when the Russians marched in and took it over, and then it became communist. And he decided, after many people were executed and he saw the brutality of this regime, that he would escape and go to the south across what was then an increasingly militarized border. He took enormous risks, went to South Korea, lived with his aunt and uncle, developed an interest in medicine, went to medical school. But then here comes Kim Il-sung marching across that border and taking South Korea, taking Seoul. And then his uncle and aunt are murdered brutally, and he has to raise their children, and he's hiding out in this house when the Americans come and take over Seoul, and he's in the middle of all this fighting, and then he volunteers to join the Marines and the 10th Corps. They say, okay, come fight with us, and here's what we're going to do. We're going to send you back up to this place called Hamhung, his hometown.
And he can't admit that it's hometown, though.
And he can't admit it's hometown because then he would be exposed as a North Korean. He believed that the Americans believed, and it was probably true, that all North Koreans were communist. So he lied and said he was from South Korea, but he took this job and went to the North, found his family up there, and a lot of other twists and turns to this saga. It's like it's an unbelievable Shaggy Dog story. It just keeps going on and on and on. And he's so humble, and he's so grateful to the Americans and the UN forces for saving South Korea, at least. He got out of that situation just barely in the 11th hour in this mass evacuation that's rather like Dunkirk, a huge evacuation of civilians, well, late in December of 1950.
Odd details, a delight in true life stories. Why were Tootsie Rolls valued so much?
Yeah, the Tootsie Roll story is one the Chosen Few Marines love to tell. In the Marine Corps, there was a code word for mortar shells, Tootsie Rolls. We're out of Tootsie Rolls. We need, you know, request shipment of more Tootsie Rolls. So they had run out, and they asked for a big shipment of Tootsie Rolls. So whoever packed the order hadn't gotten the memo. They didn't know that's what the code word was. And instead, they packed the boxes with hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Tootsie Rolls, the candy. Suddenly the battlefield is just flooded with Tootsie Rolls. And a lot of these guys were on the verge of starvation. They desperately needed sugar. They needed some kind of fuel to keep going. So a lot of these Marines say that Tootsie Rolls saved their lives and kept them going during this battle. But more importantly, they would put the Tootsie Rolls in their mouth and warm them up, and they would soften, and then they could use them as spackle, basically, as to plug bullet holes and radiators that had been damaged by shrapnel. It became like spackle that they could just smudge into any hole. because ultimately this story becomes a story of a great mass exodus back to the sea with all their vehicles. So they use the Tootsie Rolls to plug all these leaks. To this day, when they have their reunions, the chosen few men will go to these reunions and the Tootsie Roll Company is there sponsoring the thing and giving them all the Tootsie Rolls, like a lifetime supply of Tootsie Rolls. It's a company out of Chicago that still makes Tootsie Rolls. So
Chinese enjoyed the Tootsie Rolls.
But even the Chinese did. You know, whenever they flooded into a position and overran a position, that's the first thing they hunted for was Tootsie Rolls.
Now, there have been many grand names in the history of the U.S. military, but in this story, Marine Lieutenant General Alpha Bowser is a heck of a name.
That's a great one, yeah. He's really kind of the right-hand man of General Smith. I don't know where he got that name. It's an unusual one, but yeah, I love that, Alpha Bowser. Didn't make that up.
I was doing a little investigoogling to kind of bring up my knowledge to help with the interview. On the Foreign Policy magazine website, longtime military journalist Thomas Ricks had a list of the worst generals in American history. And MacArthur was one, number one, and General Almon was number three on his list.
Yes. Yeah. And Ricks thinks that Smith, General Smith of the 1st Marine Corps, is the perhaps American history's most underrated general. Few people except for Marines, just about every Marine has heard of General Smith. But outside of the Marine Corps, he's not well known, and he should be. He's famous, however, for his one saying. When it became apparent that they were not going to push to the Yalu, they were going to turn around and they were going to march to the sea. One of the British journalists that was there said, well, oh, so you're marching to the sea. So it's a retreat. You're retreating. General Smith said, retreat hell. We're just attacking in another direction, which is, of course, a euphemism for whatever, an advance to the rear, it's sometimes called, a retrograde maneuver.
But if you're being attacked from all directions, it's hardly a retreat.
Right. Well, the Marines will tell you very forcefully that it was not a retreat, that was a fighting withdrawal. You're completely surrounded in all directions by the enemy. You're right. But any movement in any direction is an attack. The trick, though, is to do it methodically and do it by the book with close air support and with flanking positions and artillery and choreograph this thing with the men and their equipment and the wounded and in some cases the dead and get them all out of there safely, shrinking the perimeter as you go. It's an art form. It's, you know, all the military textbooks say it's the hardest maneuver there is, a fighting withdrawal. Usually what it devolves into a rout and people just run, right? Well, that's not what happened here. And that's why this is a battle that's celebrated and studied so much, because it was a textbook example of a fighting withdrawal. It was done ferociously and with ingenuity and with a lot of determination and quite calmly as they advanced to the sea.
While many books have been written about it, it's not exactly a battle that's in the popular mind. You know, it's not one of those names that comes up very frequently when we talk about military. Is it because it wasn't a victorious thing of capturing the reservoir and changing the course of the war? Is that why it's not as celebrated?
Hard for me to know for sure, but I think it mainly has to do with the fact that it was in the Korean War. There really are no famous Korean War battles. You've heard of some certain place names, but because there was a movie or because there was it's mentioned certain number of times in MASH or something like that. But it's probably the most famous battle in the Korean War, certainly the most written about and the most studied and analyzed. And yet it's not very well known. And that's because it is the forgotten war. There's something about the Korean War. We seem to be a culture that understands and appreciates victory, like World War II, expects victory. We came to be a country and a culture that understands loss, you know, Vietnam. Think how many movies and TV shows and, books, great books and novels have been written about Vietnam. But this is somewhere in between. You know, it was a stalemate. The battle lines ended more or less where they started, there at the 38th parallel. The veterans of Korea say, we died for a tie. You know, there's just something incredibly unsatisfying about that narrative. Although most of the veterans believe they should have been there, you will find that they're proud of having been there and having at least saved South Korea and been there for a principle and sort of stopped the advance of world communism. Certainly when you go to Seoul today and you see it, you know, I went there with a bunch of veterans and they said, you know, this makes it seem all worth it, seeing what's become of this country. But I think that's one of the reasons why Chosen's not that well known. It is perhaps, as you alluded to, it's also a retreat, a fighting withdrawal. And yet that's the very reason why the Marines celebrated so much, is because it became apparent that, that the Marines got put in a position by other people, by higher up in the command, and it was therefore a strategic failure. They shouldn't have been there in the first place. But once the battle started, it was a succession of tactical victories that led to their reaching the coast, boarding these ships, sailing to the south, regrouping and fighting another day with their equipment intact, getting all their wounded out.
And General Smith had a difference between him and MacArthur. MacArthur thought the victory was in gaining land, and he viewed victory as in destroying the other army.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that MacArthur was very old school in a lot of ways, almost like Napoleonic, and he believed in capturing real estate and, claiming things and, yeah, especially symbolically important places like Seoul, yes. But that was his definition of victory. And Smith was very leery of that. He was really worried about this idea that his division, the 1st Marine Division, was going to get spread out over long distances on this one road that wound up into those mountains. There's only one way into those mountains. And that's exactly what began to happen. They got spread out, as any vehicular column will do. All these trucks and jeeps, rolling artillery pieces, were spread out for 40, 50 miles. That's perfect for an ambush when, the Chinese were trying to lure them into those mountains and then cut that column up to pieces, snip it into little fractions and then descend upon those fractions and surround them and destroy them. That's basically what happened, although what General Smith tried to do is slow that advance down, deliberately disobeying orders at times, while also building an airstrip up in those mountains. Ned Ullman didn't think there needed to be an airstrip. He said, "Why are you building an airstrip?" And Smith said, "Well, because of all the casualties." And Ullman said, well, what casualties? There aren't going to be any casualties. He said, "There's just a bunch of laundrymen up there, and they are going to be a problem, if they're there at all." So building an airstrip where really no airstrip should be, clawing it from the frozen earth, an airstrip big enough to accommodate these large transport planes that would take out ultimately 4,000 casualties from the battle. A lot of these men view that airstrip as really their salvation, and it was Smith who proposed it.
And it's story after story of the successes of the combat engineers who make this all possible.
Yeah, I mean, to a unique extent, this is an engineering story. That airstrip is one, and various bridges that they had built on their way to Seoul from Incheon. But then ultimately, in the Battle of Chosin Reservoir, near the end of the march to the sea, the Chinese have one last choke point, one last sort of funnel place where they realize if the Americans can get past that, the battle's probably over. And that was a bridge, a place called the Funchilin Pass Bridge. They blew that bridge, and it was over this really steep chasm. The marine engineers are scratching their heads trying to figure how are we gonna get out of this one. To build a bridge while fighting a battle, it's a really hard thing to do, let alone we don't have the parts to build such a bridge. But they figured out a way to parachute these multi-ton girders from the air. They land inside a armed perimeter which is defended, like ants defending like the queen or the bees defending the queen. And they march these parts down to the bridge site, and they fight an enormous battle while the engineers are riveting and hammering and hanging and dangling like acrobats from this bridge structure. And they finally build this bridge, and they declare it safe enough. And this long column of 13,000 Marines comes across the bridge. And as soon as they come across it, what do they do next? They blow it up so the Chinese can't come. So it's a little bit like Moses parting the Red Sea or something like that to get away from Pharaoh's soldiers. It's an amazing story. And this battle just keeps producing these little set pieces like this. It's extraordinary to me. And I picked the very best ones. But, for every one of those, there's 20 others. It's just a battle that keeps on giving in narrative terms.
I think I heard once about combat engineers that there's like a slogan, the difficult we handle immediately, the impossible will take a little bit longer.
That was the attitude they had. They were definitely resourceful and, full of ingenuity, but, but optimistic to the very end. And then, you know, of course, once they get down to the coast, they have this massive evacuation to pull off. And that also involves a certain amount of an engineering feat. They have to kind of shrink this perimeter down in a systematic way because the Chinese are still advancing. You know, start bringing in the ships one by one, evacuating everyone, then evacuating over 100,000 civilians, North Korean civilians, and then blowing all these bridges and destroying the port and, you know, kind of shrinking it down to the last few ships. And then finally, Christmas Eve, the last ship leaves, and that's the end of the battle.
How did the story come to you? How did you decide to write about this?
Well, two things. You know, I grew up in Memphis, and the first writer I ever met growing up was a great Civil War historian, Shelby Foote. I got to know him pretty well because I was friends with his son. And I remember Shelby always had a thing about Shiloh. You know, that was his battle. He certainly wrote about all the battles of Civil War ultimately, but Shiloh, I think, was his favorite one, and the one that he, you know, he walked the battlefield and he obsessed about it, and he wrote about it in the pages of fiction too. And I always had in the back of my mind, you know, I'm going to pick a battle someday. Like, you know, battles have their own quality. They have their beginning, middle, and end. Some battles just have a certain something kind of magical about them. That's one thing. I was just thinking about like finding a battle to write about. But then when I was on a book tour a number of years ago, I was signing books somewhere in Virginia, and this old veteran from the Korean War came up to the table, bought one of my books, and placed this card on the table with a hand that was missing several digits. It turned out from frostbite from the Korean War. He said, you know, you ought to write about the chosen few, frozen chosen. And I was like, you know, what's that? I have no idea. I've never heard of it. This was in 2001. He presented me with this card that said The Chosen Few, his organization. I filed that away, didn't think about it for many years, but then I dug that card out and began to look into the battle and began to realize that it was this extraordinary clash. It was a feat of arms, incredible series of battles, really. And I started to realize, you know, this is the generation that we are saying goodbye to now. Really, almost all the World War II veterans are gone, but this is the generation now, the Korean War guys. They're exiting the stage, and this war is a forgotten war in so many respects. My stepfather had fought in the Korean War. My father-in-law had Korean War orders. So I wanted to write about this generation. And then the last thing was my realization that, you know, with everything that's in the news with North Korea and with China, an increased interest in that part of the world, that this was an auspicious time to write about this conflict. I don't mean to say that I was clairvoyant. I didn't have any idea that like Trump was going to arrange this meeting with Kim and, you know, that there would be all the eyes in the world would be on this exact part of the world. But I certainly knew it was a part of the world that was begging for attention more and more. And you know, in many ways, that war never ended. We signed an armistice. We didn't actually sign an actual peace treaty. And we're still dealing with so many of the ramifications of what happened in 1950.
You've written two books set in winter-bound locations. Mm-hmm. Are you going to visit the Caribbean or somewhere closer to the equator for your next book?
I, you know, it's funny that you say that because, yes, I basically am. I realized that I was in my cold period and I need to get out of my cold period. And so my next book is going to be set in Hawaii, Fiji, Tahiti, places like that. It's a book about the third and final voyage of Captain James Cook, the British explorer.
This is really going back in time for you.
Yes, going way back to 1776 during the American Revolution. He's known for his three voyages. Most of the books are cradle-to-grave biographies, massive books of Captain Cook. But this is a book that's going to be just about that third voyage. This is the voyage where Captain Cook rediscovers, you have to say, he didn't discover it, Hawaii. It's also where when he returns to Hawaii after going to Alaska, trying to find the Northwest Passage. See there, I still get my cold weather in, despite my best intentions. He comes back to Hawaii, and he is attacked, and he is killed on the shores of the Big Island, and he's baked and quite possibly eaten. So things didn't work out so well for Captain Cook, but it's a story that has a lot of American connections to it. There are a number of officers on board who are American-born, several really interesting books that were written by Americans who happened to be on the ship. It happens during the American Revolution. They are mapping the coast of Oregon and Washington, what become Oregon and Washington, British Columbia, and Alaska. So it's got a lot of interesting American connections. And, you know, it's a great exploration story and a story of first contact. Captain Cook's very controversial among Polynesians, as you can imagine. And it's a story that will keep me busy for a long time and take me to some of these hardship posts like Tahiti and Hawaii. So looking forward to that, as is my wife.
Since you're going into a new time period for yourself, does that present more challenges for the research than since you're not as familiar with it as in other eras that you've done before?
You know, it's really hard to do purely archival history, you know, where you can't pick up a telephone and there's no lifeline there. You can't go do an interview with someone. You just have to read a lot of books and a lot of archival stuff and a lot of letters. I've done it before. My last book, In the Kingdom of Ice, was set in the 1880s. Certainly everyone was long gone. It has certain advantages, and the story is marinated for a long, long time. You have a lot of perspective on it. You can look back over 100 years or more and sort of see it in a different light, whereas something like the Korean War has still got a pulse. You know, it's still, you know, it's history, but it's very recent history. But I'm interested in the Polynesian perspective on Captain Cook, too. And there's been a lot of new scholarship in Polynesian studies because of DNA research and linguistic research. And we're learning a lot more about Polynesian society and culture across the Pacific. So I want to incorporate a lot of that, which is, you know, new scholarship, really, that's just coming to light now. So you're always trying, even with these old stories, you're trying to find something new, something that makes it resonant and current. And, you know, hopefully a little bit controversial and have a pulse of its own.
Back to On Desperate Ground for just a moment. I was struck by how much of the poor decision-making from the command structure that was going on. It reminded me last year I interviewed Mark Bowden about Hue 1968.
Right.
And Westmoreland at the time picked these arbitrary goals. And he didn't respect the NVA as an enemy. And he didn't listen to his officers in the field and what was going on. And so it seems like they learned nothing from Korea when it came down to Vietnam.
Sure. There's a lot of lessons that could have been learned in Korea that simply weren't. One of them is, you know, this is a perfect example of asymmetrical warfare. The higher command had no respect for the Chinese soldiers because they, you know, on paper, they weren't a modern army. They didn't have vehicles. They didn't have tanks. They didn't have Air Force. But they had all these other qualities. The element of surprise, flexibility of movement. They were great marchers. They were great at camouflage. They were great at ambush. These are qualities that the Vietnamese certainly had in the Vietnam War. And yes, you know, MacArthur had, although he was the supreme commander, he never spent a single night on Korean soil during the entire Korean War, which may have been fine if he had had a greater respect for the field officers. He didn't. Smith saw this battle coming. He had interrogated and interviewed a lot of Chinese prisoners that they, you know, they'd captured Chinese prisoners. Chinese prisoners said, there's hundreds of thousands of us. You know, we're just streaming down from Manchuria. All this intelligence was sent up the food chain up to Tokyo and dismissed. So yeah, that's certainly one of the takeaways, should have been one of the takeaways. Listen to the field commanders, especially in a really, you know, rugged place like Korea, isolated, hard to reach, with unfamiliar place names. You know, listen to the guys who are on the ground. You know, they probably know what they're talking about. And that's, again, another lesson that we didn't learn in Vietnam. So I think that's a pretty good analogy overall.
Hampton, I want to thank you so much for stopping back by and sharing the new book with us.
It's always good to be with you. Thanks so much.
Hampton Sides is the author of On Desperate Ground, The Marines at the Reservoir, The Korean War's Greatest Battle, which is published by Doubleday. I'm Stephen Ussery, and this is Book Talk.
Thank you for joining us today. Book Talk is recorded in the studios of WIPL in Memphis, Tennessee. If you have any questions or comments, you can email us at WIPLFM@gmail.com or write to us at Book Talk, care of WIPL, 3030 Poplar Avenue, Memphis, Tennessee, 38111, or call us at 901-415-2752.
This recording of Book Talk is licensed under the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivative Works 3.0 license for the United States. You are free to share, copy, distribute, or display and perform this work. But there are restrictions. Nothing in this license impairs or restricts WYPL's moral rights. Thank you for listening to Book Talk.